Hi, and welcome to another episode of Ask Lattice. So here with me on the Ask Lattice sofa, I've got Mina. She's a nutritionist here at Lattice, and today we're going to be answering some questions from the Women's Lattice Training Facebook community page. So the sort of questions today are along the lines of supplements for climbing, as well as any sort of fluctuations with this that we might see during the menstrual cycle. So the first one is creatine and climbing. Is this useful for us?
Yeah, we've had quite a few questions about creatine. It seems to be quite kind of topical at the moment. I don't know, it seems to be coming up quite a lot. And I think just before we go into the specifics on creatine, I think it's worth mentioning that before you get into kind of deep dives on supplements, it's really worth making sure that the rest of your nutrition is kind of in order. You know, supplements are this extra thing that we go to where maybe we want to be really specific about a goal, we want to really maximize training and or training quality in certain areas, but really, you know, creatine's not going to be a problem, a problem solver if you're not eating enough or if you're, you know, not drinking any water through the day, or you know, all those sorts of things. So it's really, we're talking about extras here.
We're talking about the top of the triangle, aren't we, really?
Exactly,
like,
after
you've built your foundation, is it worth adding these on to see if they help?
So with that caveat, creatine is probably one of the most researched ergogenic aids out there. So there's a ton of research into creatine in a variety of different sports. None specifically into climbing yet, although hopefully at some point soon. But in quite a few sports with similar kind of physiological and metabolic demands. And essentially what creatine does is, if you think about the different energy systems that we might work in within climbing, climbing is quite high intensity, which means we're going to be using those upper energy systems. So we're talking about the creatine phosphate system and the kind of other anaerobic pathways. So the creatine phosphate system, as you can probably tell by the name, is where the creatine begins to make a positive effect. And what we're essentially doing by supplementing creatine is upping your base levels of creatine so that you have more potential within that energy system. So it gives you more of that top-end power. And that's what it's shown in numerous research studies, is to kind of slightly up that top end. And it's a natural substance. It's in meat and fish and some other food products. So it's not this kind of, you know, extra chemically thing that we might think it is.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you there. And climbing in general, like you said, really high intensity. And I guess just from a lot of the other questions on the Women's Lattice Facebook community page, quite a lot of them are about trying to increase strength and power, something that just on a sort of more anecdotal basis and generally looking at the community, people seem to feel like they're struggling with. So really, this is a supplement that might be a great choice on top of, as you said, just meeting your overall energy requirements. One thing that does come up quite a lot with creatine is a little bit of weight gain potential due to the sort of water retention. So when creatine is sort of taken into your muscle cells, it does just draw in some water as well, but this doesn't necessarily have to be a negative thing, and actually for the function of your muscle cell is quite a good thing. But there may be some instances where you want to sort of stop taking it around peak performance. Do you have any comments on what those sort of scenarios might be?
Yeah, sure. It mainly depends on what your goals are and what kind of discipline you're in. For example, a boulderer, I would say that, yes, okay, you might put on a little bit of water weight, but the benefits of supplementing creatine in terms of force output and strength development is probably going to outweigh the extra weight that you're going to hold. And, I mean, it's a whole other subject, but your strongest version of yourself and your best strength to weight ratio isn't necessarily at your lightest weight. So sometimes, you know, it's that kind of offset, isn't it?
Yeah. So I guess just from that, you've got two scenarios, haven't you? You can use creatine to help your training and to get the most out of your training. And then you could stop taking it maybe for your sport climbing trip and hopefully, like, you know, not have that water weight. Or if you're a boulderer, actually you could use it in training, and then if it's helping your performance, why would you not use it on your trip?
Sorry to interrupt
you. I was there, and one other sort of topic that is discussed quite a lot on the group is sort of approaching perimenopause and menopause, and when, you know, gaining muscle mass and making strength adaptations just does become harder. And so creatine, especially around that stage of life, could be a really good supplement to consider.
Yeah, definitely. And the only other thing I would mention with the water weight is creatine kind of traditionally is supplemented with a loading protocol. And I tend to, when I work with the climbers, avoid the loading protocol because it's not really necessary. It just kind of effectively gets your creatine stores up quicker and then you continue at a maintenance dose. The only thing with that is that obviously if your stores go up quicker, so does the water weight change. And I'm always mindful of people's fingers. You know, we put a lot of weight through our fingers climbing. And especially if someone has tweaky fingers, I just wouldn't want to risk that, you know, suddenly their fingerboarding or their climbing, everything goes up by potentially 1 to 2 kilograms. Yeah. So I would usually do it without a loading phase for most climbers.
Yeah. So maybe just one thing to consider there is, you know, depending on the climber, that 1 to 2 kilograms of weight gain will be a different percentage of their, say, their max hang and the weights they're using on the fingerboard. So maybe especially if your fingerboarding load is slightly, you know, is not that much above body weight, then that might definitely be something you want to consider. Okay. So the next question, are there any changes in nutritional needs in the high hormone phase? What about supplements, things like BCAAs, omega-3 and vitamin D? And so just to sort of set the scene for those who don't know, the high hormone phase is the sort of phase of the menstrual cycle after ovulation when both estrogen and progesterone are high. So this sort of spans the time from ovulation through to day one of your period. So any changes in nutritional needs, should we chat about that first? What do you think?
Yeah, sure. So in the luteal phase, in that kind of high hormone phase of your menstrual cycle, you want to be looking at having more available carbohydrate during your training sessions. Basically, we become better at fat oxidation during that 2-week phase, and we might find it slightly harder to hit those higher intensity sessions and slightly harder to access the glycogen in the stored glycogen in our muscles. So it's worth having some top-ups during your sessions and making sure you go into your sessions well-fueled on carbohydrate. I mean, that's kind of something they'd recommend most of the time anyway, but something to be really mindful of. And maybe you can talk about the different training sessions that might be more appropriate in that phase.
Yeah, for sure. So definitely for the high intensity sessions, any of your strength and power or anaerobic capacity sessions, things like boulder triples, you definitely, like you said, want to be thinking about fueling or just being more aware of fueling before those sessions with carbohydrates. But if you do really feel that you're sort of struggling to access that intensity for these sort of sessions, potentially because you are sort of slightly preferring to oxidize fats, which fat oxidation can only take place in the aerobic energy system. So a way in which you could adjust your training a little bit is you could either use a slightly shorter anaerobic capacity or strength and power session, just so that you only have to fuel a slightly shorter amount of time. Maybe that gets rid of that sort of mid-session slump time. Or you could choose to sort of focus a little bit more on sort of lower intensity, longer end sessions, aerobic capacity sort of sessions. But of course, that always depends a little bit on your goals. If you're a boulderer, you're not just going to want to sort of replace all your bouldering sessions with aerobic capacity. But yeah, that's sort of a way that you could optimize that a little bit from the training side of things. So fueling with carbohydrates around that phase sounds like an important thing to be aware of. What about protein? Because there's always a lot of chat about protein. Is that any more important?
Sure. So your protein needs are maybe slightly higher, but pretty kind of a small amount slightly higher. Yeah. So I think so long as if you're pretty regular with your protein intake, and we want to be getting those kind of regular kind of dose pulses throughout the day of 20 to 30 grams. And you just, to be honest, I would just continue that through your luteal phase. I wouldn't worry too much about it being much higher needs there.
Yeah, one thing that I have just sort of anecdotally seen people do, because in the high hormone phase, potentially the progesterone that is high has a bit of a catabolic action in the body, is you could try having a little bit of protein before you train as well, just to reduce the muscle protein breakdown during exercise, as well as having it afterwards. Okay, so what about supplements? So some of the ones that have been mentioned are BCAAs, omega-3 and vitamin D.
Sure. So if we start with BCAAs, I mean, BCAAs are essentially a protein supplement. It's taking three of the amino acids, essential amino acids, and taking them kind of separately. To be honest, I'm not a huge fan of BCAAs. I don't think that outside of a complete whole protein source, food protein source, they're really necessary and they can be quite expensive. So, I mean, there's nothing that you can get from BCAAs that you can't get from, say, some Greek yogurt or some eggs or, other kind of protein sources.
Yeah. Okay.
So while they may have their place in terms of ease and convenience, I don't think they're absolutely necessary. To be honest, I would say if you want a supplement, you know, a powder or something, I would go for a whey protein powder or a plant complex powder rather than BCAAs. That's kind of my feeling.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, these are, because they're branched chain amino acids, so that's what BCAAs stand for. And I think the reason people take them is because these are these sort of muscle protein signaling amino acids. So leucine is a branched chain amino acid. But yeah, I'm with you. I've never personally taken them, but I do eat animal-based proteins. So potentially something to think about if you eat plant-based diet, but maybe not necessary apart from that.
Yeah, I mean, even with a plant-based diet, though, if you're combining plant sources of foods, you can absolutely kind of hit
you
enough
can,
protein
You can
there.
Hit enough. Okay, so omega-3s.
Sure, so omega-3s have been shown to have lots of different health benefits. There's quite a bit of research on omega-3s. And, you know, we're generally recommended for health to be having a certain amount of omega-3s in our diet. And you know, the most common sources, when we talk about omega-3s, we're talking about EPA and DHA specifically. And they're found in kind of fatty fish. So we're talking about like salmon and mackerel and things like that. Obviously, you can get them in supplement form.
Yeah.
You can also get some omega-3s in plant-based forms like chia seeds, flax seeds, walnuts, things like that. You actually get ALA, which is a different form of omega-3, and it's converted in the body, but it's not super efficient. So if you're plant-based, you could always supplement with microalgae, which is like a vegan version of
That's something I've never heard of.
Yeah, it's like kind of like you would get fish oil capsules, but
okay.
If you wanted a vegetarian or vegan version of that. You can supplement with microalgae
as well.
Well,
the world of supplements is vast.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, so when it comes to, I guess because I've heard quite a lot about omega-3s and something that, again, I'm not quite sure how rigorous the research is on this, but there is some potential that it could improve some sort of PMS-type symptoms. So this might be something to take either just through the high hormone phase or maybe just every day if you do suffer from some symptoms like, I don't know, menstrual cramps and potentially like a fluctuation in mood. So vitamin D, I guess we're sort of starting to head into winter now. So vitamin D sounds like one that probably all of us should have.
Yeah, sure. So vitamin D is synthesized via sunlight. So it's really our levels of vitamin. I mean, there are some food products that have some vitamin D, but predominantly a lot of our vitamin D is synthesized through sunlight. So it really depends how much exposure you're having through the summer months. A lot of people will be getting enough outside time, and that's outside time, you know, with short sleeves on, you know, actually skin exposure. During the winter, depending on the latitudes that you live at, so in kind of Europe where we are in the UK and most parts of North America, actually at the latitude you're at, even if it's a sunny day in the winter, you won't be getting the UV, enough UV for vitamin D synthesis. So I would probably recommend most people to supplement vitamin D through the winter, if not all year round.
Yeah, that sounds like there's some ones that are like worthwhile spending a little bit of money on, but maybe in the vast world of supplements, there's some where actually just a whole protein source is probably just as good.
If you were to do, one thing, I'd say probably vitamin D. There's lots of research into it for immunity, which is really important in athletic populations. You know, you can't perform well when you're sick, and exercise is a form of stress. So exercise and, you know, training loads really affect our immunity. So vitamin D is really important there. It's really important for bone health, for muscle strength and development. So it's,
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the time we spend a lot of time thinking about sort of prehab and not getting injured, but getting ill obviously really sort of hinders your training and climbing. So yeah, it sounds like that one's well worthwhile. Okay, so this one's sort of linked. What about unhealthy cravings and what is acceptable from time to time? So I feel like we've sort of touched a bit on, or quite a lot on, sort of meeting your whole nutritional requirements, say, for the day. And I know that cravings are quite a common sort of around that high hormone phase or around that PMS time. And as you've said, that actually our sort of calorie requirement might be a little bit higher around then. And I know that I personally find this is that actually when I'm craving things more, often you end up maybe going to slightly more unhealthy options. If I just focus on eating slightly larger meals, then I tend to not go down that road. And I'm not saying that not that having like biscuits is bad. I think that it's completely acceptable from time to time to have the odd treat, but I've personally found that really has helped with my cravings. What do you think about that? For other people who, yeah, feel like they have a lot of cravings, do you feel like that's quite a good approach that they could take?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's very easy to look at nutrition and to kind of overanalyze and kind of outsource everything to our kind of cognitive functions around what we think we should be eating. But our bodies are really clever, and there's a lot to be said for really listening. And, you know, I think if you're chronically getting a lot of cravings, my instinct would be to, you know, take a step back and look at your whole nutrition and say, you know, firstly, are you eating enough? You know, sometimes cravings come really from deprivation, and it's often, in terms of the people I work with, often the people that have the most cravings are the people that are under-eating the most in other parts of their lives and around their training. And so it's fixing that. And you might find that the cravings just naturally diminish. Having said that, it's also just normal to want to eat tasty things every now and again. I think there has to be room for that. You know, nutrition isn't just about performance and health. It's also about enjoyment and culture and community and connection and eating together as a family. And, you know, I think tasting and enjoying food is really important. So I also think there's definitely a place for us to not always be super hard on ourselves.
Yeah, I'm completely with you, because I think, I guess, unhealthy cravings, I don't necessarily think that cravings are unhealthy, but maybe if they are all the time, that could just be a sign of some, yeah, underlying something missing elsewhere in the picture, or potentially, I guess, doing a little bit too much. You know, we all maybe lay out how much training we want to do and we want to stick to it, but there always needs to be some sort of monitoring of how much you're doing. And despite maybe feeling like you're recovering from training, if you are having cravings all the time and almost trying to fuel your training load just with more and more, then potentially also slightly cutting down your training volume might help with the cravings, alongside looking at as your nutrition as a whole. Yeah. And I guess some good ways to do this, you know, people maybe don't want to be like number crunching loads, but maybe just try adding like another small meal or a little bit more of your sort of rice to your dinner. I guess you might have some quite simple ways to up your calorie intake without having to, I don't know, sort of change everything in your fridge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it might be that, say, it's after dinner in the evening, say you have your dinner at 7 o'clock and it's, you know, 9:30, that you always kind of want a little craving. It might be that, like you said, you could make your dinner a little bit bigger, or you could say, okay, I have my dinner at 7 o'clock, and then at 8:30 I have a little bit of Greek yogurt and some berries or something. So you have something planned in, so rather than thinking, oh, I'm going to have that same kind of fight with myself at 9:30 when I want, you know, half a pack of biscuits. No, I know that I get a bit hungry before bed and it's a good opportunity to have some more protein. So yeah, okay, I'm going to have a little snack then.
Yeah. Okay, so final question. How can we best maximize gains when time is limited? So maybe I'll just start this off on a sort of more training side of things, and then you can sort of come in with some nutrition. So I think when time is limited, some of the things I think are really important are to decide what's most important for either you or for your goals, you know, whatever climbing that you want to do, and focus your attention on those, because you can't do everything if time is limited. You maybe can't build a really good aerobic base. You can't do all the pull-ups you want to do. You can't do four fingerboard sessions a week. So try and find out what's really sort of important for you. And to be honest, that I think is the best thing that you can do to maximize the gains in a short amount of time. And then it just comes down to thinking about what equipment or gym access you have, and like maybe you use a fingerboard for a certain type of training and you use the climbing wall for another type of training. And just as an example, if I am sort of generally better at moving on the longer end of things, you know, sort of like resting and recovering, I might use the fingerboard for my longer end endurance stuff. And then when I'm on the wall and actually doing like climbing movement, I'll do bouldering, because actually this is the climbing movement that I need to work on most. And I think maybe that's where people can sort of maximize their gains, because you really want to make the most of that sort of climbing movement, really climbing specific time you have, and maybe supplement training with some of the stuff you're better at. And I guess, like, you know, fueling this to make the most out of your gains is a good way forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So making sure that you're getting enough fuel in for the work that you're doing, and thinking about bunching your nutrition around your training. So thinking about before, during, and after. So say you're going to have a 2 to 3 hour session at the wall. You're going to make sure that a couple of hours before that session, you're having a meal that has a decent amount of carbohydrate in it, and some protein and some healthy fats. And then you're going to, maybe during your session, if it's a bit longer, kind of 2 to 3 hours, you'll probably be having a top up of carbohydrate during that session. And then afterwards, you want to replenish again with some protein and some carbohydrates.
Yeah. So then you can be well recovered and ready for your session at the weekend, if you're a weekend warrior. Okay, so that's everything for today from this episode of Ask Lattice. So we'll see you again soon.